All right, so today we're going to continue in the Heart of the Matter series with part 60. There we go. That was actually quite overwhelming. Okay, so Heart of the Matter part 60. We're in 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy, and we're going to be in chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. So this is the only chapter we're going to cover here in Timothy, in 2 Timothy. Last week we did 1 Timothy. And so that will leave us just with Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, 1 John, and Revelation, and then we're done, just about. Who knows what else might pop up. So anyway, 2 Timothy chapter 2. Now remember, the letters to Timothy, we talked about this last week, are a little bit different than what Paul was doing in the other letters to his congregations. These are letters to a student, helping them to understand how to do their role now as being sent out to represent not only Shaul as the teacher, but Mashiach, Yeshua, as well as our Father in the heavens. So this is a letter to his student, helping him with the things that he needs to deal with and handle. He says, "You then, my son, be strong in the favor that is in Messiah Yeshua. And what you have heard from me among many witnesses, and trust these to trustworthy men who shall be competent to teach others as well." Okay, so again, I feel like we're just beating the same dead horse more to death here, but isn't it what you see here, what Paul's talking about, the idea that there are supposed to be those who are competent and teaching? See, Paul didn't think it was just enough to set up a bunch of elders in a congregation, as some of the teachers out there have tried to put forth, and just say, okay, now you do everything in this sort of circles of elders, but it's the idea, look, I want you, Timothy, to take what you've learned from me, and I'm entrusting you to entrust these things to trustworthy men, which means that you need to vet them out, build a relationship with them, get to know them and understand with the fruit, are they trustworthy men? Are they men of commitment, of dedication? See, we have a lot of challenges when it comes to commitment and dedication. We've been talking about that a lot during the Hanukkah season here because it's the feast of dedication. And how dedicated are we? We're looking for trustworthy men who are dedicated to their role in doing what? In being competent teachers of other people. He says, I want you to entrust these things, the things that you have heard from me among many witnesses. So he's saying not just what you've heard a lot of one person here, one person here, claim I said. What do you know I've actually been doing and teaching? What you've heard from me and you've heard from many witnesses. Take these things and entrust them to trustworthy men who shall be competent to teach others as well. We're supposed to have teachers. I'm not saying the Ruach HaKodesh does not have a role in this. Of course, the Spirit has a role. But the Spirit is not going to be your exclusive teacher. The Spirit leads you to find those teachers that the Spirit is now going to work through. And then help you to understand what those teachers are saying. So that there's a connection in your being when you hear a teaching the truth, and the Ruach is saying, that's it right there. That's what you want to grab a hold of. That's what you want to just embrace. That's it. The Ruach helps you to know, yes, that was it. That's what I needed. However, you may sit there going, I've read that verse 47 times and never saw that before, because the Ruach has not chosen to teach you that way. Not your fault necessarily. It's just, we don't get to choose how this is done. Now, there's a lot of teachers out there, or people with microphones claiming, well, we don't need a teacher, we've got the Ruach. The Ruach's going to do all the teaching. And I've said this over and over again, then why is it that we all have 57 different opinions on everything? If the Ruach is actually doing all the teaching, the problem is the Ruach isn't doing all the teaching. We got a lot of people out there just teaching, and that's why we're not all on the same page. So yes, the Ruach is critical to all of this. The Spirit is critical, but he says, look, again, there are supposed to be trustworthy, competent teachers. And I've said it over and over and over again, you have a responsibility to yourself in your walk to find these men. At least find one. And we know that in Ephesians, when we talk about the fivefold ministry, that Paul says that these men are supposed to still be around until we all come into the fullness and the unity of Mashiach, which we're not there yet. So they're supposed to be around. So here he's telling Timothy, one of your jobs as my disciple is to now take that process forward and disciple others who are going to also disciple others. He says, but don't just disciple everybody and anybody and send them out. He says, go and find trustworthy men who are competent teachers. Who are competent teachers. That means they have a talent for teaching. And also they're going to teach what they were told to teach and not just go off in any direction they feel like. There's a duplication process here. They are trustworthy and competent. Verse 3, suffer hardship with us as a good soldier of Yeshua Messiah. So now he's kind of throwing in there, by the way, just so you know, when you do choose this path to be a teacher, you're going to suffer. He just wanted to have full disclosure. Just like FYI, full disclosure here, you know, you're going to suffer. You know, the elder at the congregation that I'm going to be speaking with over in Australia, he did a teaching on leadership not too long ago. And in it, he was talking, in a sense, a precursor to ordaining two gentlemen. And he was kind of laying out there, by the way, guys, just so you know, when I ordain you, that when you come into leadership, you are going to lose your friends. You're going to lose family members. You're going to lose your reputation. You're going to lose money. You're going to lose, I mean, he just had this long list. He says, so aren't you excited now that I'm going to ordain you? Bet you can't wait. But the thing is, people generally don't spend a lot of time thinking about what happens when you step into this role. You think, after all, if I come into this role, everybody's going to do two things. Absolutely. They're going to love me and agree with everything I say. And I want someone who's doing that right now to let me know how that's working for you. Oh, they're just going to love me and believe and agree with everything I say, because after all, I'm just going to show them every verse and how it works. I've done that lots of times. It doesn't always work. Matter of fact, it doesn't often work, because we're dealing with a lot of self-sovereign, stiff-necked Israelites. I mean, we come sort of by it naturally, as it says. You know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You want to call yourself an Israelite? Well, generally, we're known as being, you know, hard-hearted and stiff-necked. So when you act that way, guess what? You're acting just like your ancestors, and not the good part of the way they acted either. So he's warning them, and he says, look, you go and find these guys and entrust them to teach. Well, just understand that suffering hardship with us is what we're going to do. You have to be a good soldier. And interesting that he says good soldier. Now, it's interesting how, to me, I would take that maybe in a very different way than most of mainstream Christianity has over the years, because they actually think about going to war. I'm thinking good soldiers are ones that obey orders, follow direction, and are in line with what's going on from headquarters. I think that's probably what he means here. You are a soldier of Messiah Yeshua. You are, yes, sir, up to with what Yeshua says. It's not about pulling out the sword and going to battle. He says, you go ahead and be a good soldier and you suffer hardship. See, that good soldier that wants to draw a sword out isn't wanting to suffer hardship. He's wanting to go and make you pay for trying to make him suffer hardship. He says, no, you suffer that hardship and you take it like a good soldier of Messiah Yeshua. Because soldiers of Messiah Yeshua don't worry about getting beat up and attacked. We're supposed to count it a good thing to suffer with Messiah. It's a blessing to suffer with Messiah. We've talked about that in other teachings. But he says, I want you to be a good soldier. He says, verse 4, no one serving as a soldier gets involved in the affairs of this life in order to please only him who enlisted him as a soldier. See, that's the good soldier. He says, you're not going to become a soldier because you want to get involved in the affairs of this life. What you're going to do is you want to be able to please the one who enlisted you. Your whole focus is to please the one who enlisted you. Well, who enlisted you? Messiah Yeshua. And in this case, Timothy was enlisted by Shaul, who was enlisted by Yeshua. And in this case, Timothy's going to go out and enlist trustworthy, competent teachers. He says, no one serving as a soldier gets involved in the affairs of this life. No one serving as a soldier gets involved in the affairs of his life. You mean spending 4, 5, 6 hours a day focused on what, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans and the liberals and the conservatives and Trump and Hillary and Obama and all, you know, in other words, you don't get all involved in all that. You pay attention because what they're doing may affect things that may trigger end time events. And so you're kind of being aware. But there's a difference between being aware and keeping tabs and actually being involved. He says, no one serving soldier gets involved in the affairs. In other words, taking an active role or emotionally involving yourself where you actually are, you know, basically have a dog in the hunt, so to speak. Okay? Or people saying, you know, I've got a dog in this race, or I've got an issue in it. You have no vested interest. But yet we have people all the time who, when they watch that news, and then they go on Facebook, or they go wherever, and they're all posting about what, and that includes, by the way, what Netanyahu's doing, what the Knesset is doing. Don't get so involved. Pay attention. He says, you've got a role. What's your role? Your role is to please the one who enlisted you. And so what is that to do? To preach the gospel, the good news about what it's going to take to go from who you are and to become what he is so that you can go from where you are into the kingdom. That's what you were enlisted to do. And if you're not a teacher, now of course here he's talking to teachers. He's talking to Timothy who's going to go out and teach other teachers. He said, but for all the rest of us, our role is to do that by living it. By being a living example of what that path is that the teachers are teaching. To be a living example of what it looks like to transform from who you are into who he is. To transform from being here at this moment into being ready to be in the kingdom when it comes. So you have that role. We have to be careful though. It's so easy for us to get all involved in world affairs, life. It says here, do not get involved in the affairs of this life. And we are way too involved in those affairs. I'm not saying don't pay attention. I turn on the news every day because you know what? Something may happen. Because I remember when 9/11 happened, I wasn't watching the news. I wasn't aware anything was going on. As a matter of fact, I called a friend of mine who yelled at me over the phone saying, yes, I'm watching it. Because I must have been like the 8th person that called her. And I was like, watching what? Because I didn't know. She goes, what do you mean watching what? And she told me what was happening, and immediately I ran and turned on the TV. So I do check the TV from time to time to see what's going on. But I don't get involved. And that's the key here. He says, this is especially for those who are going to be teachers. You teachers out there, understand that your role is to please him who enlisted you, not to get involved in the affairs of this life. Verse 5, if anyone competes in a game, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. Oh, that's an interesting idea. So he uses some metaphors that are very common to Paul's writings as well as other writings where he talks about the idea of the crown of life. We have a teaching called endure and receive the crown of life. And so we're told that we have a future that perhaps if we get there and everybody, you know, is hoping to be at a place where you become a king and a priest. Well, if you're going to become a king and priest, there's a crown metaphorically connected to the idea of being a king. So he's saying here, look, if you're going to compete in a game, and we've heard many people over the years talk about life as a game, the game of life. So you're competing in this game called life. Well, you're not going to be crowned. You're not going to win. You're not going to be successful unless you compete according to the rules. And so, what are the rules of life? I feel, and many of you feel the same, that the Torah is the rules of life. And so, if you're going to compete and receive a crown, he's saying you're not going to do that if you're not going to play according to the rules, and those rules being Torah. Now, this is the guy, this is Shaul, you know, the one who wrote Ephesians, Colossians, Galatians, and all the other letters. This is the guy who's attributed, or, you know, people have considered the one who says that, you know, don't you know the law's been done away with and we don't have to do anything? Now, here he's saying, excuse me, if you're going to compete, You're not going to get crowned unless you compete according to the rules. What rules? I thought this was the guy that did away with all the rules. You see, he didn't do that. He never, in his mind, ever thought that there were going to be a doing away of with rules. And he's making that really clear. This is Timothy being told as a teacher and student of Shaul, who's going to find and teach others to do teaching, make sure that those teachers teach their students that you don't get to win and receive a crown if you're not keeping and playing according to the rules. That's a very hard thing for all those people that have the once saved, always saved, and all these other things where, well, you know, what do the rules have to do with anything? He says, no, no, the crown is not received unless you compete according to the rules. So you have to know what the rules are. The hardworking farmer ought to be first to receive his share of the crops. Okay, so he's just throwing a bunch of things out there that have, remember, again, let's get back to context. I just interrupted myself, I'm sorry. Let's get back to context. In context, we've talked about this over the years. It has to do with who's speaking. Right? That tells you a lot about what's going on, who the audience is, what they're talking about, why are they even talking about it, why is it an issue, where are they, when is this happening? A lot of these things could affect the context. Well, this is Shaul, remember again, talking to one of his, now notice he talks to his disciple, he calls him son. Discipleship was a very close relationship. It wasn't just a student sitting in a classroom with a teacher. And he's saying to Timothy, he says, my son, be strong in the favor that is of Messiah Yeshua. He says, now I'm entrusting you to take what I've entrusted you with and go find others like I found you and train them. So in the context of all of this, remember, because Christianity does a brutal job on this, where they take verses that really are not about you and apply them to you or tell you you can apply them to yourself. So we can maybe make some inferences of how this could be about every one of us, but let's understand on the very simple Peshat level, this is about those who will be in a teaching role. This is a leadership letter to a leader. And he's saying, look, those leaders, if they want to be successful, they got to do things according to the rules, and if they're going to be a hardworking farmer, they ought to first be able to receive their share of the crops. In other words, he's saying it's appropriate and proper for those that are doing the farming, the work, the teaching, for them to get a share in the crops. Because there's a lot of people out there attacking anybody out there teaching and doing so at the with the support of people in the congregation. They, you know, you ought to have a job, you know, because Paul had a job and others had a job. Well, because, you know, when you're first planting congregations, generally speaking, they don't have the finances or the desire to support you so that you could be supported. You better have a way to make money, to make a living. When I came here and started this congregation, I had a career. I had a job. I had a way to do that. I was a licensed real estate agent. And I had a job working here at RE/MAX with one of the top agents in the whole, you know, city of Chattanooga. Only thing is, Abba grew this so fast, I never even got to really do much with it. But that was his choice. I came fully prepared and licensed to work. Does it make sense? However, once the farming was going and the crop was being harvested, the provision was made so that I would not have to do that. Not only, and it's not so much that I wouldn't, oh, I feel so bad for you, you had to do that. No, I had no time to do it. There was no ability to do it because the needs of the people took up all of the time. And so, yes, it was good that Shaul had a skill so that when he went someplace, he could make a living if needed. But I promise you, he hardly spent time doing that in a lot of places once he was there for a little while because his ministry needs far outweighed any ability for him time to be making tents or talits or whatever he was making. And I do speculate that he was making talits and not tents. Okay? Okay, so it would make more sense that if you're a traveling rabbi, that you would be bringing things that are the instruments and tools that your students may need. So you would bring talits. And he probably made tzitzit and all these other things and had them for people. So here he's encouraging, saying, look, the hardworking farmer ought to be first to receive his share of the crops. Think over what I say, for the master shall give you understanding into all of this. Ah, see, verse 7 shows you the ruach's role. the Master Messiah Yeshua, through the means by which we've taught over and over again, the Ruach, will help you to understand and confirm all of what I just said. See, there is the role of the Ruach playing into this. He says, look, think over what I said. In other words, meditate on this, pray about it, for the Master shall give you understanding into all this. So he's saying things knowing full well that there may be more depth to it, like I've tried to bring more depth to it. Instead of just sitting there going, okay, a hardworking farmer ought to be first to receive crops. So what if I'm not a farmer? What if we have a guy? It's not about being a farmer. Okay, it's a metaphor, a picture for those putting in the effort, being able to receive based on their effort, the produce of their effort, the fruit of their labors. Remember that Yeshua Messiah, verse 8 now, remember that Yeshua Messiah of the seed of David was raised from the dead according to my good news, for which I suffer hardship as a criminal unto chains, but the word of Elohim is not chained. So he's trying to say, look, just look at me. This could be your future. But realize that even if this is your future, the word of Elohim is not chained. So don't fear what they might do to you. You do what you're supposed to do. Remember, your job is to do what? Your job is to please him who enlisted you. Okay, back to verse 4, right? Your job is to please him who enlisted you. Would it not be fair to say that the one who drew you, no one comes unless the Father draws, but also his other verse says, no one comes to the Father except through me. And so Yeshua, you have to be drawn. So you're enlisted because there's a drawing that comes. He draws, he selects and enlists you. He's using a military metaphor here, but we can change that metaphor around to understanding it fits into the same idea of drawing. Chosen. Many are chosen. This idea that you're chosen, selected, enlisted, etc. It's all the same thing. And he says, verse 10, so I endure through it all for the sake of the chosen, those who are selected, enlisted, etc., so that they too obtain deliverance, which is in Messiah Yeshua with everlasting esteem. He says, I endure through it all for the sake of the chosen, so that they too obtain deliverance. In other words, he's saying, look, there are people that are watching me, watching what I do, see me suffering, see my willingness to suffer for this message, who are going to be strengthened by my level of dedication and commitment. You see, but a lot of us, and I counsel a lot of you, so I'm not trying to read your mail out loud, but a lot of you come to me, and when these things get real challenging, all of a sudden, so does your level of commitment and dedication. And you start to waver. And what Paul is saying here, what Shaul is saying here, is that when things get horrible, you need to get even stronger in your commitment and dedication, because the endurance is the key. And that's why that teaching was so important that I'd shared with you, called Endure and Receive the Crown of Life. Because a lot of us were sold that bill of goods in the mainstream church that said, basically, believe in Messiah and everything's going to come out roses. You know, gold coins are going to pop out of your ears and whatever. I mean, you know, we were sold that everything's going to be wonderful once you make that decision. They lied to you, okay? They lied to you. The scripture says, no, if you make this decision in this world that still is not the world of Yeshua, but the world of HaSatan, this world, this fleshly existing pre-Yeshua's coming to reign, if you choose to follow him now, he says, you will suffer. And the question is, are you willing to do that? Because then, you know, you make this decision, you expect all this. See, you read the blessings and cursings chapters, and you thought, well, once I do all these things, I keep Torah, I'm keeping Sabbath, I'm eating right, I'm keeping holy days, I stopped all these other things I shouldn't be doing, so shouldn't I just be walking in nothing but blessing right now? No. You should definitely experience moments of it, good chunks of time of blessing, so that you are encouraged to keep going, so you see that it works. But ultimately, he says that you are going to suffer. And you're suffering for his name's sake, for his authority's sake, for the word, for the truth. And so Shaul says, I endure through it all for the sake of the chosen. So he's saying, I don't do this even for me. I do it for you, for those of the elect, those of the chosen, so that they too obtain deliverance, which is in Messiah Yeshua. So you want true deliverance? True deliverance is getting to the point where you no longer are afraid. You're no longer afraid of what happens to you or is done to you or happens around you. You're just walking forward. That's true deliverance. And so he wants these people to have true deliverance. And so he says, I do this so they can see what that looks like. That whether I'm shipwrecked, whether I'm receiving stripes, whether I'm locked up in jail, I'm still enduring. I'm still committed. I'm still dedicated to the work of being an enlisted soldier of Yeshua. And all I'm trying to do is please the one who enlisted me. Verse 11, trustworthy is the word, for if we died with him, we shall also live with him. That's what he's holding on to. That's what he's got the strong grasp on. He's saying, look, I'm holding on to this understanding that he is trustworthy in the word. The word says that if we died with him, we shall also live with him. You see, but if you died with him and then resurrected yourself back into the old man, so to speak, by going back and returning to, you know, like the dog to its vomit, how do you expect to live with him? If you died with him, burying all the old man, burying that old sinful way of life, committing to walk forward in the truth, in the Torah, in honor and respect, in the fruit of the Spirit, it says, and truly you shall also live with him. If we endure, we shall also reign with him. I don't know why people seem to miss that verse right there. Reigning with him is connected to endurance. If you're saved, and this is one of the things I get attacked on more than anything else out there, so I'll throw some more fodder on the fire, so to speak. If you're saved as a completed status, okay? In other words, by the way, salvation is not a status. It's a process. But he said, if you think you're saved, meaning your status is I've got a completed process here, then what's there to endure? I'm saved. Because you see, there are those out there that when the parable of the sower plays through and the cares of this world and all these other things come to try to choke you out and cause you strife and cause you suffering and pain, some of the people in that, you know, parable don't endure. And it's because their roots haven't gone deep. See, it's dedication and commitment that puts the roots deep. Your level, I don't think I've ever said this before. I believe now that this is coming out, this is how it's coming out of the mouth right now. I believe your level of dedication and commitment is the measurement of how deep your roots are. I think that's a reasonable thing to say. It's not informational. In other words, having more knowledge and information doesn't necessarily give you deep roots. It may give you lots of roots, very shallow. Anybody pull up a plant that's got lots of roots all going left and right, not very deep, and just yank it right up? But there are other plants that have a lot less roots, but boy, they go real deep, and they're hard to pull out. Your level of dedication and commitment, I believe, is equivalent to and represents your level of depth of your roots in the metaphor of the parable of the sower. And he's saying here, if we endure, which will only be done if your roots are nice and deep, if we endure, we shall also reign with him. Is that not the destiny we're all hoping with, you know, anticipation and excitement to have, is to reign and rule with Messiah? That's the destiny we all believe in? Well, guess what? Endurance is required to get there. He says, if we deny him, he also shall deny us. So what does it mean to deny him? I think it gets really wrapped up way too simplistically in people saying, I deny that Yeshua is Messiah. No, I think it's a much more complex thing than that. I'm not saying that denying him and saying Yeshua is not Messiah is not part of it. I think that when you don't do what he says, He says, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. John says, if you say you know him and don't keep the commandments, you're a liar. I think that you're denying him, but when you claim to be of him and then do things that are completely the opposite of what he desires. In other words, let's go back to the verse that says, the one who is enlisted does only the efforts that are necessary to please the one who does the enlisting. So if you're claiming to be enlisted by Yeshua, then your actions will demonstrate whether or not that's true or not, or whether you're denying him. Because, you know, you walk around and tell all your friends, hey, I'm a child of the living Elohim. I follow Yeshua Messiah. I wear tzitzit to declare who I am. I don't eat pork anymore. I don't keep Christmas and Easter. I keep Saturday, not Sunday. And then we see you in the store on Saturday. Or then we see you doing whatever. I mean, just you can fill in that blank with almost anything that you know ends up showing and denying that what you claim is just not true. It's denying that what you claim is true. So I don't think it's so simple that it says it is impossible he says if we deny him, he's going to deny us. You know what denying us looks like in the verse in Matthew where it says, those who said, Lord, Lord, Master, Master, and he said, get away from me, I don't know you. Now, why would he say, I don't know you? He says, because you really didn't know me. You claimed to know me, but your actions demonstrated that you didn't know me at all. Like he said, like John said, if you claim you know him and do not do as he said, don't keep his commandments, you're a liar. Now, it doesn't mean you're doing it on purpose. I'm going to really make this simple. I don't think any Christians, okay, I'll just make it real easy, are lying on purpose claiming they know him and don't do what he says. They've been lied to. They're only walking in what they understand. But John says, if you say you know him, have a relationship, and that word know always is a relational thing, that you have a deep and knowing relationship with Messiah and do not keep his commandments, he's saying basically you're wrong. Using the word liar is a little tough because liar generally kind of has a context or a connotation of intent. Okay? So let's take the intent out of there. In other words, if you claim that you know him and don't do what he said, you're just showing that you don't know him. I think that's maybe a more user-friendly way of saying it. Because I know when we use the word liar, I at least, you know, immediately think that the person's doing it on purpose. I don't think these people are doing it on purpose. I think the people who went to Yeshua and said, Master, Master, we did all these things in your name. I think those people were the most shocked people on the planet when he said, get away from me, I didn't even know you. They were like, what? They had no idea that they didn't have that relationship. But what does he say at the end of that? He said, because you are workers of Torahlessness, of lawlessness, anomia. I know that a lot of times in the Christian churches, they try to twist that into iniquity. Now, the actual Greek is lawlessness or Torahlessness. In other words, you're not keeping the law. You're not keeping the commandments. And so here he says, look, if we deny him, I'm going to say through our actions and words, not just words, then he also shall deny us. You know what he's going to deny us? He's not going to deny, look, he's part of the Creator. I mean, he's the Creator who brought us into being, right? He's not going to deny that we exist and that he knows it. He's going to deny us access. Does that make more sense? If you deny him in your behavior, he's going to deny you access in the end. When he says, get away from me, I don't know you. He says, if we are not trustworthy, he remains trustworthy. It is impossible for him to deny himself. Now, this is, again, one of those verses where Christianity will say, well, because he's trustworthy, it's impossible for him. So we're fine because he's trustworthy. That's not what it says. It says, if we're not trustworthy, that doesn't mean he's not trustworthy. He's going to do what he said. So when we do the things that cause him to see that we're denying him, he is going to deny us. We can count on him doing everything he said he will do. Problem is, we've not been trustworthy to do everything we claimed that we would do. When you declared to be a son of the living Elohim, when you declared to be of Messiah Yeshua, when you declared to come under covenant, you declared to be submissive to the rules of the game. Verse 5. You declared that you would be part. The covenant rules were listed in Exodus 19 when he says, if you agree to do what I say, in other words, play by my rules, I agree to take you as my people. And so here he's saying it just in his own different metaphor. Here he's saying, look, if we are not trustworthy, well, don't think for a second that he's going to then be lackadaisical about what he committed to too. No, he's going to keep his part of this. Of course, Christians want to go to that and says, well, he's trustworthy, and it says that none can pluck you out of his hand and all this other stuff. Well, it doesn't say you can't climb out. Although I heard somebody the other day who was attacking me say, oh, well, you know, you can't pluck out of a hand. You can't even climb out. Really? Where does it say that part of the verse? No, no. If he's got a hold of you, no one can take you out of there. But you can choose. You've got free will. That's the denying him. How else can you deny? He says, if we deny him, can we agree for a second that verse 12 is talking about what Christians would call a saved person? In other words, he says, if we endure, saved people, using Christian terms here, we shall reign with him. But if we deny him, I mean, he's not talking to Gentiles here who are just out there doing everything and anything. Can we agree? He's talking to people that are taught, instructed, and claiming to be of the body. So how can somebody like that deny him if they're once saved, always saved, and whatever? I don't think that would work. It says that we're not trustworthy. He remains trustworthy because it's impossible for him to deny himself. Remind them of this, earnestly witnessing before the master, not to wage verbal battles, which are useless, to the overthrowing of the hearers. How many times does Paul have to talk about how useless it is to argue and argue and argue? And yet, what do you see in the body? Arguing, arguing, arguing. Am I wrong? Arguing, 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 arguing. You know, I'm going to say something, and maybe this is going to come out wrong. Maybe it's going to come out prideful. I have no idea. We're going to say it anyway. You know, there's a verse that talks about in the future, the 10 men of every nation will grab onto the tzitzit of a Yehudite, a Jewish man. Now, it doesn't say that this is going to be a Jewish messianic who has all of a sudden realized that, you know, the Hebrew language has been changed and now Yeshua becomes Yahashua, Hushua, and all this other stuff. It says a Jewish man. It doesn't mean that this Jewish man is not wearing tzitzit. Doesn't mean this Jewish man doesn't wear a tallit. Doesn't mean this Jewish man stops being Jewish. It said a Jew. But we have so much anti-Semitism in the body. The Jews don't know anything because after all, you Gentiles who came into this, you know, after 5 minutes or even your whole life, let's even say you're 50, 60 years old, and the Jews have been doing this for almost 6,000 years, or if you want to start with Judah, so about, you know, so we'll go back, say 4,000 years or whatever, they don't know anything. And so that's what's going on here. But you know what? Someone posted on Facebook the other day, and I loved it, because it never even occurred to me how true it is. He says, how come you have, well, let me just remember how it was posted. He said, let's say you were in a belief system where everybody agreed on how to pronounce and spell the honored and respected name. For example, in Christianity, that would be Jesus, right? Everybody spells it the same way, pronounces it the same, etc. And then you're expected to change and switch into this thing called the Messianic, where nobody seems to agree on how to pronounce the honored and spell the name, etc. However, all of the Jews, and I think about it, I think it's probably true, every Jewish believer that I interact with all says Yeshua. There's not a single Jewish person that I know. I could be wrong. If you're online, you can straighten me out. None of them say Yahshua, Yehoshua, Yahashawushawusha, Yahusha. I'm saying none of them. But see, yet nobody wants to listen to us Jews. Now, we're not claiming we know everything and we're right about everything. But I think it's interesting that the Jews in the body don't make an issue of how to spell the name. They know it's Yeshua. And then I get people recently on YouTube, happens every week on YouTube, saying, well, how come you say Yeshua? How come you don't say this or that? And it's always some person who's 5 minutes into this, who's doing their best understanding of Hebrew, which they don't understand. And so that's what the guy posted. He says, how come a Jew who's raised with Hebrew and taught Hebrew says Yeshua, every one of them, but it's the Gentiles who have no Hebrew background who all come in and they all of a sudden they know better how to pronounce the name? How is that? See, the body, I think, is really confused and suffering because we have very few good Jewish believing teachers. Because unfortunately, a lot of the Jews in the body want to bring everybody into full-blown Judaism. I don't want to do that. I don't want to get you to have to submit to the Talmud and all these other things. But can we at least respect that Judah just may know a little bit differently and may be a little bit more correct in what we're doing? You know, it says that Judah will not have the scepter, will not part from between his feet until Shiloh comes. We're talking about Messiah Yeshua in fullness. Not that he came and that was enough. We're talking about when he comes to rule and reign. That's what Shiloh is talking about. It's not talking about the suffering Mashiach ben Yosef. So that means the scepter, the authority, the instruction, the leadership is supposed to still be Judah. Oh no, you don't. I'm going to get attacked all over the internet because I just said that. I don't know how you don't understand that. I'm not trying to elevate, again, I wanted to make sure this came across. This isn't about elevating me in some form because I'm Jewish. It just simply is the frustration of those in the leadership who happen to be of Jewish background, not understanding why there's such a callous disregard for that the Jew may actually know anything. Am I saying the Jews never made any mistakes? Of course not. But we have no respect at all. Not all of you. I know a lot of you greatly respect. But we see this going on. And he says over and over again, this is what triggered it. It was in verse 14. He says, but we wage all these verbal battles, which are useless. Do you ever watch the Jewish community? Now, I don't mean the Jewish community is fighting with other Jewish communities. I mean in one community, meaning within the conservative movement or within the Chabad movement or within the, you know, whatever it is, the particular movement, there's no fighting. There's no arguing. There's respect for authority and for leadership. Show me that anywhere in the Messianic body. Show it to me in any single congregation. You know what? I've been a part of Jewish synagogues for years and years and years and years before I came into this. And I don't remember ever watching them argue and fight over scripture. Ever. And nobody ever argued with the rabbi, ever. But yet, and we expect that this is what the body looks like. We call ourselves a body. I don't, even Frankenstein wouldn't build anything this messed up. Okay? Because we basically have like toes on our hands. We've got fingers on our knees. We've got elbows on our foreheads. I don't know what we look like. You know? I could use other anatomy, describing where we could have certain pieces of our body, but I think I'd get like shut down on YouTube or something. But we've got our head in a wrong place. And we're thinking out of a wrong place. And you can laugh, but this is what we're doing. Because why? Because I'm so smart and I'm so right and everybody has to agree with me. That's what every single person out there thinks. And I need to find only places that agree with me because after all, I'm so smart. Because the Ruach called me. And the Ruach teaches me. And that, come on. Haven't you had enough of being completely disconnected and disjointed in the mess that we are? And here's Paul all those years ago saying, look, He says, remind them. He's saying to Timothy, remind these teachers who you're going to be teaching. By the way, that's how we know he's talking to, quote unquote, believing members of this body community. He's saying, look, I'm still talking about those teachers. Remind them of this, earnestly witnessing before the master. In other words, do what you need to with strength of conviction. However, don't wage verbal battles. They're useless to the overthrowing of the hearers. In other words, then the hearers don't want to listen anymore. The hearers will not want to listen anymore because of all the verbal battles. It's sad. He says, do your utmost to present yourselves approved to Elohim. This is what we should be doing. Do your utmost to present yourself approved to Elohim, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly handling the word of truth. Ah, but see, that's the verse that gives everybody the excuse to do it their way. Oh, well, I'm just rightly handling the word of truth. Not if you're fighting and arguing and not being submitted to any kind of authority. Because the word of truth is not just figuring out the right calendar or the right way to pronounce the name or other little things that you guys all like to fight about. The word also talks about structure and leadership and submission, meekness and gentleness and love and joy, etc. The word talks about a lot of things other than just being completely, you know, anally right about every little detail. Oh, no. It says I got to do my utmost to, you know, present myself approved to Elohim. That's the key part of the verse. Not just the rightly handling the word, but do your utmost to present yourself approved. Elohim does not approve of what we're doing right now in the body. The word says it everywhere. Elohim does not approve of how we're treating each other and how we're representing him. What's it going to take to get us to wake up to that? Oh, but I'm rightly handling the word of truth. Are you? Why? Because you think you figured the calendar out or the nature of the Godhead or whatever thing is your pet favorite thing that you go around pestering everybody about? Sorry, but this is just, you know, as a teacher, I look at the body and other teachers and we talk about these things and we're like, what needs to be done to get the body to remember it's supposed to be a body? And to recognize that the body has a head. And then there's smaller examples of the body within the body that also have to have a head. But we don't understand these things. He says, but keep away from profane, empty babblings, for they go on to more wickedness. These profane, empty babblings, what is he talking about here? He says, we fight and we argue and we discuss and we do all these things that have nothing to do with anything. Oh, well, we elevated it to be the most important thing there is, period. But you're missing the point. So by babblings, I don't think he's talking about speaking in tongues. I don't think he's talking about, he just says, you're just babbling, blah, 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 about a bunch of nonsense that really is not that important that you think is the most important thing that ever existed. He says, stop that. Because in a way, you're profaning. How are you profaning? Because we're denying him in our behavior. Because now people think, as what you're doing, that you're representing him now. So now you're profaning him. Because you just claim to represent him. And then people look at you and go, okay, let's see what that looks like. Really? That's what it looks like? And they've kind of got this curious look on their face as they're staring at you going, okay, so that's what it looks like to claim to be a Torah observant Messianic Israelite. So, intolerant, obnoxious, unyielding, unrelenting. This is what it looks like. Self-righteous. I don't remember those being in Galatians 5:23. Now, a lot of the stuff was in Galatians 5:20, 19, and 20, where it talked about the bad parts of the wrong spirit. But the fruit of the spirit of Elohim, the Ruach HaKodesh, doesn't have all of that ugly stuff in it. But that's what we end up behaving mostly like. Selfish, self-centered, self-righteous, obnoxious, unyielding, impatient, judgmental. Need I continue? Isn't that what we look like? Isn't that what we run into all the time? He says, keep away from all that stuff, because in that way you're profaning your claim to be his. He says, and their word shall eat its way like gangrene. Then he mentions two people that he said are of that sort. So, do you understand gangrene will kill you? So that kind of behavior is going to kill you. That not only that, it's going to kill others. Because, after all, if you're the one representing this whole thing, and you're selling, and you're basically presenting it or selling it to me, so to speak, you're presenting it to me, and I look at that and I go, I'm not interested. Why would anybody want that? If that's what you're presenting as being, I think you need to give up Christmas and Easter and Sunday and come be a messianic person so you can judge people and be obnoxious and whack people in the head with the Torah and all this other stuff. Isn't that exciting? Come join me. No, that's okay. I'll pass. I'd rather just sit here eating my ham sandwich where everybody's treating each other much nicer. And they're not fighting and ugly and, you know, all this kind of stuff. No, thanks. I'll pass. Are we demonstrating the good part of this? You know, I do remember, I'll use myself as an example here real quickly. You know, when I came into Torah observance in the context of Messiah, I was in my early 20s. I was just out of college, and my mother had a good friend whose son had just gone to Israel and come back and decided he was become Orthodox. All right, so now they're comparing notes. My mother, who's not necessarily thrilled that I became a believer in Messiah, and her friend, whose son went from just a regular sort of secular Jew to full-blown Orthodox. And so her friend is saying, it's a nightmare, nothing's good enough, the dishes are this and the this, because it's a regular secular Jewish house, and now he's become full halachic Orthodox Jew. And so he can't even live in the same house with his family because they're not doing things halachically the way the Orthodox would do. So he's driving his mother insane. And my mother's realizing that since I came into belief in Messiah, I've actually become easier to deal with and less argumentative. And my language has cleaned up quite a bit. And all of a sudden she realized, you know what, maybe I don't have it so bad. But are we doing the same thing? Are people seeing the positive changes in you? Because it's supposed to be from the heart, right? This whole teaching is about the heart. Well, we'll get to a verse that mentions the heart here in a second. But it's all about the heart, right? As your heart changes, can people see you now with that different heart? You see, because if your personality has not been affected, then where's the heart change? We talk about this week after week after week. It's not enough to change the mechanics. Okay, so I went from Sunday to Saturday. That's a mechanical change. I stopped eating pork, I'm eating better. Okay, I stopped Christmas and Easter, I'm keeping feasts. Those are all mechanical changes. Maybe you had drug habits, maybe you were sleeping around. Okay, these are mechanical changes when you stop doing them. What about, though, becoming kind, gentle, meek, loving, joyful, filled with the Spirit so people are attracted to you and saying, wow, what do you have going on that's changed you from the jerk you used to be into this other person? I need to know what's made that difference in your life. Maybe you weren't a jerk. Maybe you were always afraid and scared and whining and complaining, and now you stop doing that. Because now you have faith and belief and trust. Whatever it was before, people should see the difference. And then ask the question, what is it? In other words, let's say you were 100 pounds overweight, and then someone hadn't seen you in a while, and then you've lost the weight. They're going to ask you, how'd you do it? How did you lose the weight? Or that you used to smoke and now you don't smoke, and say, what did you do? Did you use patches? Did you use this? People want to know how you made a change. But do they see any change? Well, I don't do Sunday anymore. Well, that's a mechanical change. Do they see the more profound change, changing who you are to look like who he is? Do they see that more profound change? Because then they may come up to you and say, what's made that difference? Yeshua, obedience to the commandments, understanding the right way to love him and love each other, the two great commands. Where'd you learn all that? It's in the book. What book? In the scriptures. I've read that book. I don't remember that stuff. Well, it's in the stuff left of Matthew. It's also in the stuff right of Matthew. They just don't know how to interpret it. Continuing. And so he mentions these two people who also were not doing things correctly. And he says, these people have missed the goal concerning the truth, verse 18, saying that the resurrection has already taken place and overthrow the belief of some. So he's saying, look, be careful when you claim to be a teacher, which apparently these two people were teachers. And this is, remember, an instruction to Timothy to find trustworthy, competent people to teach. He said, these people are causing a stumbling for some. It's an overthrowing of their belief for some. Because after all, we're striving to do what we're doing because we have a hope of a resurrection to come. These people are saying, well, it's already come. You missed the boat, basically. So if you didn't get to be involved in it, you missed it. And so they're saying, well, then what's the point? We have no belief. He says, however, the solid foundation of Elohim stands firm, having this seal. Yahweh knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of Messiah turn away from unrighteousness. Ah, there's the key. This is the solid foundation of Elohim that stands firm. Having this seal, Yahweh does know who are his. By the way, you're claiming you're his doesn't make you his. Don't you remember the wheat and the tares? Both the wheat and tares thought they were wheat. Sat next to each other in services thinking they're both wheat. And we don't have any of us qualified to decide who's who. We're told that in the parable, right? It's not for you to decide. He says, I'll send the ones who are qualified later. And we're not to that later point yet. That's at the end. He said, however, that he not only does he know who are his, he said, but let everyone who names the name of Messiah turn away from that old way of life, the way that was lawless and unrighteous, because those are the ones, he says, I don't know you, get away from me. Turn away from unrighteousness. Now, unrighteousness is not just saying to change from Sunday to Saturday and get all those mechanics. It is unrighteous when we treat people in those harsh, unloving ways. He said, we've got to turn away from that. It says, but in a large house, there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some unto value and some unto no value. So he's saying in a house, we've got all kinds, it's a mix. In other words, every group gathering is a mixed crowd. Some of them are going to be gold, some of them are going to be wood and clay. Gold and silver, but you know what? We don't get to decide who is who and what is what. That's what he's saying. He says, if then anyone cleanses himself from these matters, he shall be a vessel unto value, having been set apart of good use to the master, having been prepared for every good work. See, Paul uses that word quite a lot. And not to say that we are, you know, works were done away with, there's no value in works. He says you're being prepared to actually do good works. The whole point is that you have been changed to know the difference between a good work and a bad work. What's righteous and what's unrighteous. By the way, those are just big words to say what's right and what's wrong. Righteous simply means it's right. Unrighteous means it's not right. It's just a big word. But he says, look, if you cleanse yourself from these matters, you can be a vessel that has value. He says, because look, some have value, some don't have value, verse 20. Those who are working righteousness, you have value. If you choose to not work righteousness, to work unrighteousness, now you don't have value. He says, and flee, verse 22, flee from the lusts of youth, but pursue righteousness. He says, so he's going to give you a perspective on the action. The lusts of youth, meaning before you grew up and matured. It doesn't have to do with just when you were young as in physical age. He wants you to flee from them. Okay, that's a picture of strength. It doesn't be like, oh, well, I don't think I like that, and just kind of stroll and maybe look over your shoulder. No, no. Run as fast as you can. Fleeing means that in front of you is something that could kill you, and you're trying to get away from it. That's fleeing. You're running as fast as you can away from it. Flee from the lust of the youth, but pursue righteousness. Pursue what's right. And by the way, in pursuit, that's like hunting down. You're going to track it down. You're going to hunt it down. You're going to pursue it, and you're going to be relentless until you get it. It didn't just say kind of casually look for. Pursue righteousness, belief, love, peace. Pursue these things with those calling on the master out of a clean heart. It says, so he wants you to not only flee the lust of youth, but he wants you to pursue these things, righteousness, belief, love, peace, etc., with others that are calling on the master out of a clean heart. See, there's the word heart finally in this whole discussion. All of this is an encouragement, which is kind of the foundation of why we built MTOI. MTOI is an organization, Messianic Torah Observant Israel, has the whole function and vision and purpose is working together to serve the body in a more effective way. And he's saying that here, to a teacher named Timothy, who's seeking to train up more teachers, I want you to pursue belief, love, peace, etc. Righteousness, belief, love, and peace with the others that you find who are calling on the master out of a clean heart. That's what we're trying to do. We are trying to find those who are calling on the master in a clean heart and work together in belief, in righteousness, and peace, and love, etc. He says, but refuse foolish and stupid questions, knowing that they breed quarrels. Okay, Robert, the next time we get emails and they're just stupid and foolish questions, we're just going to refuse to answer them. I'm only kidding, because people don't realize they're asking foolish and stupid questions. Okay, but he says to me that we can refuse those. You know those emails where it says like rejected mail? Like when someone mails you something, you can refuse it? Couldn't you do that with email? Refuse for being stupid and foolish. But refuse... Like the 500th time someone wants to ask me why I call myself rabbi. Okay, stop that already. We're going to do a teaching on that soon, just to cover that. But anyway, but refuse foolish and stupid questions, knowing that they breed quarrels. Because I promise you, this video will have at least one person going, but why do you call yourself rabbi? You don't understand Matthew 23, that's why. Okay? All right. But they breed quarrels. By the way, use this as a lesson. If you don't know if your questions are stupid or foolish, look at the fruit. When you ask them in general, do they cause quarrels? And all of you know what I'm talking about, because you'll bring up a certain subject, whether it's divorce and remarriage or the nature of the Godhead or calendars or whatever, a pronunciation of names, and next thing you know, a fight breaks out or a quarrel. And then you act all surprised, even though that's happened 57 times in a row, without exception. So if you, that may give you a hint. What you're asking is foolish and stupid because it's causing a quarrel. Now, by the way, that doesn't mean if you bring those questions to a leader and the leader now can now work with you, as long as you're not just sitting there intending to argue. Because for you, you might really need an answer to the question. But when you're asking people on your level, so to speak, instead of vertically asking, but on your level, and never ask those questions of someone that are newer than you are, okay? Don't ask. Remember, we're all in sort of a grid that kind of figure out wherever you are, there's always people that are newer than you. Okay, that got, you know, that you've been doing this longer, and those have been doing it longer than you, and there are people that you should be asking, and there are also those on your same level. Okay, when you have a question, why is it that you ask people down the line instead of up the line? But you guys do that all the time. You start asking somebody who's been doing this, you know, not even half as long as you have, but you're going to ask them. Or you'll ask somebody who's been doing it just as long as you have. Why are you asking them? Come up the line, ask somebody who's been doing this longer. That's why we're here, so that we can answer questions, you know, even if they're foolish and stupid. By the way, Robert and I would never look at each other and say, man, that's a dumb question. It's not. It's just that, understand that the questions that are being put out there, when you already know it's going to cause a fight, because it's done it every time, that's when it becomes foolish that you keep asking those questions, or at least asking them in the wrong group, in the wrong context. And it's foolish that you don't understand that these things breed quarrels. And a servant of the master should not quarrel, but be gentle towards all, able to teach, patient when wronged, in meekness instructing those who are in opposition. Now, this part, verse 25, is translated very badly, so I'm going to help you with the translation. In meekness instructing those who are in opposition, it says here, lest somehow Elohim gives them repentance unto a thorough knowledge of the truth. So somehow it looks like that, well, I'm going to do this in meekness and say everything so that Elohim doesn't give them repentance. The better translation of the Greek here is, and perhaps Elohim will give them repentance. If you do this stuff patiently in meekness, instructing those who are in opposition, perhaps Elohim will give them repentance unto a thorough knowledge of the truth. He's saying, though, if you're going to fight with them and argue with them and beat them up and do all these other things with and not be patient, he's not going to, maybe he won't give them that. But be patient with them. Let him work with them. Let him help them to see that maybe they're wrong. By the way, if you're being patient, he may also give you time to realize you were wrong. He says, and they come to their senses out of the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his desire. So I'm hoping that this is starting to make sense. This is instruction, first of all, to teachers. If you're going to be a teacher, you absolutely need to learn verse 24 and 25 that you need to be a servant of the master and not quarreling, but being gentle towards all, able to teach, patient when wronged, in meekness instructing those who are in opposition. Now, by the way, when we see everybody out there who doesn't agree with me or doesn't agree with somebody else, and they're bashing and attacking, and are they doing this here? No. We talked about that last week because I've been attacked recently. And by the way, those same guys have attacked me again, and that's okay. You know, Yeshua got attacked all the time. Paul got attacked. Look, it is what it is. But the thing is, somehow we have to learn how to react patiently when wronged. It's not easy to do, though, because what do we want? We want justice now, so we want to lash out and try to fix it now. And I want my pound of flesh, and, you know, we have that phrase. But it's not right. No, it's not, but it is what it is. Sometimes we just have to accept the is what it is phrase, you know. Let's go before the Father. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King, Father, help us to truly want to do what's pleasing in the eyes of the one who enlisted us. Father, that we can understand what pleases you and your Son, Yeshua, what you expect of us. How can we be good, trustworthy, dedicated, competent teachers? How can we use our lives as a teaching? How can we be okay suffering hardship as good soldiers with Messiah? How can we learn not to ask these, you know, not so much ask, but to constantly bring up foolish and stupid things that cause quarrels and fighting? And how do we be gentle to all and patient when wronged, and all these other things. Father, we need your strength and guidance and wisdom so that we can do our utmost to present ourselves approved to you, that we could be workers who are not ashamed, but rightly handling the word of truth. Yeshua is the word of truth. The Torah is the word of truth. We know that you have given us a spirit of truth. Father, we need your help. Lead us to those men. Lead us to those people that you've called, anointed, and appointed who are good and trustworthy and competent to answer questions and to teach, and who can do so in a gentle and patient and non-quarreling way. And for all of us teachers, help us to walk in the walk in this manner so that we will not cause others to stumble or to lose their belief. Father, we just thank you for your word. We thank you for using Shaul to witness to us through his instructions to Timothy, and that way we all be able to take what is written here and apply it in our lives now and immediately in a way that then brings more glory and more honor to you and no longer denies or profanes your holy name. So, Father, we thank you for your instruction and for your guidance, for your wisdom, understanding, and discernment. In the name of our Messiah and our coming King, Yeshua Mashiachinu, amen, amen.